Dalton, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, 5 minutes, please.
All right. You may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Dorian Dalton. I'm here on behalf of David Lee Washington. As to the sufficiency issue, Mr. Washington's position is that there was not sufficient evidence to prove prescription fraud because there was no evidence of fraud. The trial court, in its finding of guilt, held that concealment of a material fact was proven and found Washington guilty because he either knew or should have known that he had more pills than he was supposed to have, but did not tell the pharmacy that he had too many pills.
Counsel, let me see if I can work my way through the facts, because obviously this case is going to turn on what facts are there and what facts are not there if we're talking about a sufficiency case. As I understand the record, and please correct me if I'm wrong, your client was given a prescription for Xanax, or Alprolix, which is a generic brand of Xanax.
Correct.
And as I understand it, this prescription had no specific designation as to how many pills he was supposed to receive over a period of time. Correct or incorrect?
I believe the prescription was for 90 pills.
Over a course of time?
Yes, for 1 month prescription.
Okay.
And the prescription itself had 3 refills.
Okay, it had 3 refills, so he would have been, quote, I'm using this term loosely, entitled to how many pills? 270?
90 times 3, yes.
My math's pretty good. My fourth grade professor or teacher would be proud. So he was entitled, and I'm using that term loosely, 200 to 270 pills.
Well, I guess 90 times 4 if he filled all
360 pills.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Was there any evidence in the record, as far as you are aware, that your client actually went to the pharmacist to have this prescription filled?
No.
Okay. Was there anyone who testified that they saw your client having this prescription filled?
No.
Okay. When the case was argued before the fact finder at the trial level, what was it, as you understand, the Commonwealth's basis for suggesting that there was fraud here?
The Commonwealth's basis for suggesting
yes,
fraud?
Ma'am.
I assume just that the defendant's statements that he received without evidence that he himself went and had the all of the prescriptions filled, too many pills, and that at some point, I guess there's no evidence, even if the defendant's statements are considered in evidence, as to when this realization occurred.
Okay, so the fraud, as you understand it, and I'm sure Mr. Blanton's going to correct the record if I'm misstating it, is your client should have known that he should not have received this amount of pills over this period of time, and so therefore should not have engaged in the action that he engaged in.
Yes, and the court's specific finding is that the court specifically, if you look at 18.2258.1, excluded the first, second, and fourth basis of fraud and found the third basis of fraud, concealment of material fact, based on the lack of evidence that Washington disclosed to the pharmacy that he had received too many pills at whatever point he made that realization.
Ms. Dalton, I'm a little confused about the issue before us. Your assignment of error is that there was insufficient evidence, but the basis for that is your assumption or your allegation that the trial court incorrectly relied on statements that had been properly excluded.
Yes, sir.
And as I read that, it appeared to me that the issue in this case was whether or not the trial court had relied on statements that were excluded.
I think the issue is that there's insufficient evidence in the record.
Well, then why would you bring up the issue of the statement? Why?
That was brought up because it exists in the record and because of the specific basis on which the trial court made its ruling.
Well,
I think that
if we conclude that the trial court properly admitted, or at least if we conclude that the statement was admitted without objection, let me put it that way, the playing of the statement was admitted without objection, is there evidence to support the conviction?
No. Even if the statements are in there, there's insufficient evidence. There's still no evidence of fraud. His statements would only consist of the evidence that was otherwise missing, that he actually received these prescriptions.
Well, didn't you argue that he acknowledged that at some point he realized he was getting too many?
That was in the defendant's statements, yes. that he acknowledged to the detective that at some point he realized he had too many pills.
Well, isn't that evidence of fraud?
No, I would suggest that it's not. That it would not be the receiving of too many pills. It would be a fraudulent act that caused the receiving of too many pills.
I'm sorry.
So it's the acquisition of the pills that you believe has formed the basis for the fraud?
Yes.
Not the receiving of the pills?
Yes, and I certainly, I think that it's clear that it could be received by accident, or that he could be receiving what we would characterize as too many pills by act of Dr. Essa in prescribing him too many pills.
Let me ask you this, though. Whether she did, whether she prescribed all those pills, let's assume for the purpose of my question that she prescribed too many over time. He knew that he'd been taking these for about a year, right? So he knew that you take 90 pills in a month, essentially. That's not something that you dispute. You know, 3 pills a day times 30 days or approximately 90.
I think it's difficult to suggest that he understood the instance out of his prescription, but I think we could assume it for the sake of the question.
But he'd been taking them for a year.
I think for longer than that.
Okay.
For years.
And so the first prescription he filled on August 3rd, right?
I believe so.
And then on August 8th, he filled another one.
I think maybe the 9th.
And then the 9th, he filled another one, right? 8th, 9th, and 29th is what I thought.
Maybe not the 3rd. The 8th, the 9th, the 29th, and the 30th.
Okay.
Right. Maybe the 3rd instead of the 8th.
Okay. So within a month. August, he filled a prescription 4 times and got 90 pills each time. Wasn't each time in a different pharmacy?
I believe that is contained in the record through the detective's testimony.
So why, you know, we're looking at a rational fact finder standard of review here because of sufficiency of the evidence. Why, if he's filling 4, he's been taking this for years, so he knows he takes 90 a month, he's filling 4 prescriptions in the month of August, each for 90 pills, or as you say, 360, 90 times 4, 360. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't even do it the same pharmacist. He goes to different pharmacies each time. Why can't a rational fact finder conclude he knew what he was doing here?
Well, I think that's the unexplained fact. And I think that it is certainly possible that he had prescriptions at different pharmacies anyway for a variety of reasons, or that the doctor's office, by accident or for some other reason, sent them to the different pharmacies. And I think that's also assuming that Mr. Washington himself went and retrieved those prescriptions from different pharmacies, but I would suggest to the court that there is no, I don't think it's suspicious to have prescriptions at different pharmacies.
Right, but it's, all of these are prescriptions by Dr. Essa, or do we know that?
I think the detective's testimony established that all of the prescriptions that he was investigating had the same doctor code, which indicated that they were authorized by Dr. Essa.
Did the doctor testify that in order to get a prescription, the person would have to come in and request it?
I think she testified that the individual to whom the drugs were prescribed would have to take some sort of action, either at the pharmacy or by contacting her.
So if he went in knowing that he already had the allowable supply of these drugs, went in and requested a prescription and did not reveal that fact, omitted that fact, concealed it, why would that not be a fraud on the doctor?
On the doctor or on the pharmacist?
Or on the doctor in obtaining the prescription in the first instance.
I think if the doctor authorizes it, then it's not fraud.
Even though the defendant effectively lied to the doctor to get the prescription or conceal the material fact?
I guess I'm having a difficulty understanding what sort of...
What would be your definition of fraud?
I would only limit it to the types of fraud prohibited by the prescription fraud statute.
Okay, and what would, using that as that definition, what would be your, I guess, Hornbook definition of fraud based upon analysis of that statute?
I think some sort of false representation or it could certainly be a lie. The statute does allow for the concealment of material fact.
Suppose, let's take this hypothetical, and I know we're talking about something that, let's assume that the facts work for this hypothetical. Suppose I order a TV off of the internet, mm-hmm. okay? And they send me the TV, and they also send me another TV. I get two. And I kept the second TV knowing that I wasn't supposed to have this TV. Would that be fraud?
I would suggest it's not. You didn't do an act to cause the result.
Even if I refused to return the TV set that I knew that I wasn't entitled to?
If they contacted you and asked you to return it, that might be a different situation if you just sort of took advantage of a mistake to your own advantage. It would not necessarily be fraud.
Ms. Dalton, you're into your rebuttal. You can continue or reserve as you wish.
I'll reserve. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Blant?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is John Blant, and I'm representing the Commonwealth in this appeal. The first thing I would like to note is that I think in the record, and I couldn't find it just a moment ago, but there was reference to the fact that Mr. Washington had been taking Xanax for approximately 10 years. He had been seeing Dr. Essa for a little more than a year, and that's where that confusion came in. As to whether or not he did acts to procure the fraud, I think it's very clear in the record that he did. Both Mr. Fitzgerald, the pharmacist from Lafayette Pharmacy, and Dr. Essa testified that they don't give refills without the patient asking for them. If I go to a pharmacy and give a prescription and come back 30 days later to get a refill, I've got to either call in with the prescription number and say, I need to get this refilled, or I need to come in and get it refilled. If my prescription is run out and I need to get a new prescription for the medication, I have to call my doctor. My doctor will not say, oh, it's been 3 months. Mr. Blanton must need his new prescription for whatever drug it is, so I'll send the prescription off to the pharmacy. I have to call and ask him to do that.
Well, maybe my experience is a little bit different. I take sinus medication that I have to take, particularly during...
I thought you were going to tell us it was Xanax.
No, well, that too sometimes. When I'm working with you, I take Xanax. But I have this prescription that's on file at the CVS, and my allergies usually break out in March and April, September and October, and CVS will start calling me right during the allergy season. They'll start out with this thing, this is the allergy season and we know that you need to have this allergy medication, so come in and get it. Your prescription is here waiting for you. I don't have to do anything. I don't call them. I don't tell them that I'm sneezing all over the place. They just say, come in and get my prescription. So my experience is a little different from yours.
Well, I understand, and hopefully you won't report CVS, but the evidence in the record here from Mr. Fitzgerald and from Dr. Essa, they don't do that. And my experience on that, I take asthma medication. I have to call to get a new prescription. I have to call to get the refill. I have to do an action.
Does the record indicate what schedule this drug is?
It's a Schedule 4, if I remember correctly. I think that's early in Detective Taylor's, it's in Dr. S's testimony.
Would it make a difference if it's automatically refilled, if you have to go in there and pick it up? Does that make a difference if it's just there waiting for you?
I think it would, but in this case, we have, and it's not only in August, but there's Detective Taylor referred to the July 11th, the August 3rd, August 8th, August 9th, August 29th, August 30th. There are five in August. And why the July and the other August weren't charged, I have no idea. But in any case, the defendant admitted he knew he shouldn't have that many. He knew and he's going to different pharmacies to get these refilled. And I think that's a perfectly valid presumption that you're getting the same prescription refilled again and again and again, or you're getting the same prescription filled again and again, and you're going to different pharmacies, you've got fraudulent intent. And I will note that Mr. Fitzgerald testified that that prescription from August 29th, which was actually written on August 3rd, was an original fill. It was not a refill. So he had gotten that prescription and he called and asked to have it placed at different pharmacies.
Was there any specific evidence that you can recall in the record that suggests that the defendant here, Mr. Washington, actually went to the pharmacy to pick these prescriptions up? Is there anything to...
There is for the Lafayette Pharmacy. The other, it's from, my understanding is it's from the CD, the, mm-hmm. the Detective excuse me, I'm getting names confused, Detective Taylor, said that he admitted that he picked up the testimony, the inference was that on August 3rd, he went to this pharmacy to pick up this prescription. On August 8th, he went to this pharmacy. On August 29th.
So his statements against interest, I guess would be the best way to describe them, would provide that predicate. Let's talk about the issue that I think your opponent colleague is raising with regard to the exclusion of evidence. As I understand, this was a judge trial, correct?
Correct.
Is it your argument that by the judge's ruling, evidentiary ruling that he made with regard to the statement, that the trial judge was suggesting that part of this statement was inadmissible, the other part of the statement may be admissible if it's appropriately presented, and that the judge, because it was a judge trial, was within his prerogative to parse that ruling that he made and make that portion of the defendant's statements admissible?
I think, if I follow you, yes, that is our argument.
Which would be different, I guess, if this were a jury trial, because a jury wouldn't be able to make that parsing.
Absolutely. It would be very, very much different at that point. And on that issue, I apologize, but in doing some research in preparation for trial, I ran across a couple of cases that I think are very instructive on this. The first one is Roe versus Commonwealth. It's a Supreme Court of Virginia case, 271 Virginia 453, and both of these are 2006 cases. The other one is out of this court. It's Sandoval versus the Commonwealth. It is record number 1165044. It is obviously unpublished. I have copies of those cases if the court would like.
I think we can, you could give them to the clerk.
Thank you, ma'am. And I think Sandoval is really on point for this one, because, and the proposition for both of these cases is the trial court is the proper, is allowed and has the authority to interpret its own rulings. In Sandoval, it was a two-day trial. There was a motion to strike the sexual battery charge. The court ruled that the Commonwealth hadn't proved force. We'll strike it as to force. Wrote the order up that had been struck and asked to force. The next day, the Commonwealth came in for and amended the charge to carnal knowledge, which was the sexual battery essentially without force. And the defendant said, no, you struck the charge last night. The court said, no, we struck the force portion. And this court held that the court had its authority to interpret its order, so long as it's reasonable interpretation of its order and it's neither arbitrary or capricious.
The trial judge did there is reduce the exposure the defendant had from a sentencing standpoint, but didn't strike the nature of the charge generally.
Correct. But it came down to who interpreted that order, and the court was allowed to interpret its own order. And I think essentially what the judge did in this trial was give an order that may not have been very clear on the record. But when he considered it, clearly he was interpreting his order. When he considered the rest of the statements on that tape, the defendant's statements, he was clearly interpreting his order to not exclude those statements.
And it was the same trial judge who made the determination on the motion to suppress that actually heard the trial on the merits.
There was no motion to suppress. This was the tape was objected to when it was played.
Yeah, the exclusion of the evidence. But it was the same trial judge who made the evidentiary ruling. That was actually the trial judge who heard the evidence.
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Blaine, can I ask you the same question I asked appellant's counsel early on? What is the issue before us? It appeared to me, when I read this assignment of error, that it basically said the only reason the trial court erred in finding the defendant guilty is because it incorrectly relied on statements that had been properly admitted. So I read that to mean the issue before us is were these statements improperly relied upon or not. Now I'm hearing the argument that it doesn't matter whether the statements came in properly or not. The evidence was insufficient regardless.
And I'll be honest, I was somewhat confused in reading the assignment of error and the brief going into the full onslaught of why the defendant believes the evidence was not sufficient. So. I agree. I think the assignment of error, if that evidence was properly received by the court and properly referred to, then I don't think there's an assignment. I think that the issue is moot at that point.
I mean, we see assignments of error all the time that say that the trial court erred in convicting the defendant of murder because there was insufficient evidence of malice. And under that assignment of error, we don't allow counsel to argue that he wasn't the criminal agent either. So
I agree. I think If that assumption is incorrect, I think the assignment of error then falls short, I think.
Well, we then that would focus on the, then we'd have to decide whether the evidence was relied upon, where inadmissible evidence was relied upon or not.
And I think, to be honest with you, given the status of this case, it is difficult to do that, but I think when you read Detective Taylor's testimony and you read the judge's comments, as well as counsel both for the Commonwealth and for the defendant, I think they both reference, they bring up different portions of the tape, and I think counsel admitted that this was essentially a confession, albeit an uncorroborated confession, and it's our position that actually, no, that confession was corroborated both by the pharmacist's testimony, the doctor's testimony, and Detective Taylor's testimony.
I'd just like to follow up on what you just said. You said it would be difficult. Am I misunderstanding you that it would be without the statements from the CD that the trial judge originally excluded, that it would be difficult to find sufficient evidence here?
It's harder because we don't have a record of those statements. And that is what I meant by that. And that goes back to
So you don't think that, you know, the four pharmacies or the five pharmacies, whatever it is, with the five prescriptions in August. Four pharmacies for five prescriptions, essentially. Five different prescriptions in August. That along with the fact he's taken it for 10 years and they're all prescribed by Dr. Essa, that doesn't give enough evidence without
that
statements
is absolutely
from the,
right there.
I'm sorry?
No, you are correct. We've got Detective Taylor testifying to what his statements were, and so the information does come in a manner that
but
is sufficient.
But do we know whether that is all that was in those recordings?
There is more in the recordings.
Do we know, for instance, that the defendant absolutely did not admit to doing or virtually give it, it confessed to doing this in the statement, and it just didn't come out through the detective?
I'm not sure.
It was a double negative there, I believe. Without knowing what was in the recording, how can we determine whether or not the defendant admitted to this crime or not?
I think it comes out from Detective Taylor's testimony, the comments of both counsel and the trial judge.
So we have to assume that is all that was in the recording. There was nothing additional.
Well, I have listened to the recording, and I can tell you that there are other things in the recording as well. But
that's kind of my problem. You've listened to it, but I haven't and can't. So I don't know.
And the trial judge did.
And that's the thing. What we have is Detective Taylor's.
Did and said he couldn't admit. We couldn't be admitted.
We have Detective Taylor's testimony about what was in there. We have the arguments of counsel, which I understand is not evidence, but they had heard the evidence and their arguments were based on that. And
I guess my question boils down to, just to follow up on it again, is if the CD was excluded by the trial judge, but then he relied on two statements from it, that I think one of them being,
I knew
I had too many pills or something like that. Isn't there enough other evidence here, or to say that's essentially harmless error or not?
Yes, I agree. I think there is. And it comes primarily from Detective Taylor's testimony. And when you bring in Dr. Essa's and Mr. Fitzgerald's testimony about how the refills are done and how prescriptions are sent to pharmacies and things like that, you realize that he's got, at this point, 450 pills in a one-month period. And
pharmacies don't deliver these pharmacies at all, do they?
No.
I was trying to figure out how
that was. I have no idea. All I know is it was Edlow's here in the city. It was Rite Aid up on Broad Street. It's Lafayette, somewhat out in the west end of the city, and MCV was also involved peripherally in it.
Mr. Blanton, help me with this. I'm a little confused at this point. It's my understanding that the physical CD was not admitted into evidence.
Correct.
But portions of the conversations recorded on that CD were played to the court without objection.
As I understand, the whole CD was played in its entirety. There were objections during the playing of the CD to hearsay in the questions of the detective. Specifically, when the detective was first testifying without the CD, he said, The defendant received 90 pills from Edlow's. There was objection to the fact that he didn't know there were 90 pills other than from the pharmacist at Edlow's, and that was hearsay. And the court said, let me just hear the tape. Let me just hear this thing.
So is it your position that everything that was on that CD and those portions of the conversation that were played from that CD were ruled to be inadmissible by the trial judge?
They were not ruled to be inadmissible by the trial judge because the defendant admitted in his objections to the hearsay, he said, the counsel said, my client's statements are admissible. So there's hearsay. There was an objection that they're hearsay in the questions of the detective.
Somebody needs to go to evidence 101.
But I think even if the court comes back to the position that the whole tape was excluded, the whole interview was excluded, I think then, and that was on hearsay grounds, then we're at a 518 argument, because when the court ruled on the termination of guilt, and I'm running out of time, I ask if I can go ahead and finish my answer. Thank you. When the court ruled, the defendant had a duty to object based on ruling based on facts not in evidence. That is not the same as a hearsay objection. You need to make the specific objection, and even if the tape is excluded, the defendant never made an explicit and specific objection, to that ruling on that basis. Thank you
very much.
I ask you to affirm.
Ms. Dalton, you have the majority of your rebuttal remaining.
Thank you. I don't think there's any doubt that the trial judge did get confused at certain portions of making his finding of guilt. He also, I'd point out to this court, stated that the defendant testified, and that simply did not happen.
What do you think was admitted from that CD? Any or all?
Nothing.
So your position is when the trial court said, I'm not going to admit the CD, he effectively ruled that none of the conversations that had been previously played were going to be admitted?
Yes, and it was when the Commonwealth went to actually admit the recording, the judge was like, no, I'm excluding it. He said, in its entirety, or he didn't say those words, he said, we're going to keep it out. It's not admitted into evidence. And the trial court could have accepted Washington's statements to his exclusion of the recording and admitted his statements only, but the trial court did not state the Washington statements were admitted into evidence.
Did trial counsel say something to the effect of, there's no doubt that the defendant's statements could come in?
During the objection?
During the course of the trial?
Yes.
So isn't that approbating and reprobating?
Well, I would submit that that was his position as to his objection to the hearsay, and that the trial court had the discretion to go beyond that and exclude it in its entirety. And I would suggest that it's clear that that's what the trial court did, not only because the entirety of the CD was excluded, but because he held that the inadmissible evidence that the detective obtained during the course of his investigation were bleeding into the defendant's responses
but
to his questions.
Doesn't Mr. Blanton's argument to the contrary make sense? In other words, we have a bench trial where we're not really concerned about a jury not being able to parse evidentiary rulings. Coupled with that, we have trial counsel's own representation that the statement is admissible. Why are we reading more into what the trial judge did than we need to, when it's clear that pretty much everybody was singing from the same sheet of music?
Well, I think it's clear what the trial court did because he excluded the recording. He did not let it into evidence. That's why it's not contained in the record.
Right. Nobody asked for any clarification. So,
unfortunately, that's true.
So why wouldn't we presume that the trial court decided that portions of it were admissible and portions of it weren't, so he wasn't going to admit the physical CD?
I think because his ruling to exclude it was his final ruling on the matter, which I would suggest reversed any prior rulings to the contrary, and also indicated that he...
But you're presuming that, and there's no evidence in the record to show that.
Well, he didn't state that he was allowing in the defendant's testimony, and I would submit that the burden was on the Commonwealth at that point to argue the limited admissibility.
The burden's on you now to prove trial court error.
Yes, but I'm saying that the trial court did not state he was letting in the statements, nor did the Commonwealth ask that they be admitted for the limited purpose after the trial court excluded them.
Well, why wouldn't it be reasonable to assume that the trial court basically said, look, there's some portions of conversations on that CD that are admissible. There's some portions on there that are inadmissible. We've heard the admissible through testimony or through playing of the recording. I'm not going to admit the whole thing because of the inadmissible portions that it contains.
And if this court rules that that is how the trial court ruled, then I would suggest that there's still not sufficient evidence for prescription fraud, even given those statements.
Can I ask you something? In the joint appendix, I think it's on 57, I made a note of this. Defense counsel stated he acknowledged at some point he realized he was getting too many. And I'm assuming this statement is from the CD.
It is.
Because it's not in the transcript. But when defense counsel talks about this to the court, hasn't he brought it in at that point? Isn't that essentially an invitation to the court for error?
I think trial counsel did get confused as well, but and assumed that the court was ruling in, I guess, the way that he had originally objected, but I was essentially trying to cover all the bases that even with those statements, it's not enough that there's no time frame as to when that realization occurred.
When what realization occurred?
Mr. Washington's realization that he had gotten too many.
Oh, okay. So you're not sure whether that's after he's done all of these? I mean, I guess that goes back to my question with regard to the rational fact finder standard of review. He's filled, you know, four different pharmacies.
And there was, I would just point out to the court, there was no evidence from the other pharmacies indicating that Mr. Washington picked the prescription up or how the prescription was received by the pharmacy.
Well, eventually he got it, though. He knew he got it.
He did. But
even if a friend picked it up for him.
Right. And with Lafayette, I'd like to point out that Lafayette Pharmacy, the only evidence of the pharmacy that we have from August 29th, indicated that they received the fax from Dr. S's office.
Is it your position that the fraud has to be perpetrated on the pharmacy? Or can it
be
perpetrated on
the
doctor? On the doctor. I mean, there's clearly a material omission of material facts here to the doctor, isn't there?
Not necessarily. I think Dr. S's testimony was cut short by her pleading the Fifth Amendment and refusing to answer additional questions.
All right, your time has expired. Thank you for
your
argument.